Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, no secret here. Most of us who eat meat don't like to think about how it's produced, do we? But what if you could produce meat without having to raise or slaughter an animal? This half hour, my guest is journalist Chase Purdy. He is a reporter for the media company Quartz, where he explores the business, politics, and technologies that are changing the landscape of food and how we interact with it. His latest book is called Billion Dollar Burger, Inside Big Tech's Race for the Future of Food. And in it, he writes about the people working to upend the trillion-dollar meat industry by producing what is currently called cell-cultured meat, that is, meat grown in a lab, meat that was never part of a cow, a pig, a chicken, a turkey. How is this possible, you say? Well, let's talk to Chase Purdy to find out. Chase, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating book about the race for the future of food, and also you address how the entrenched interests in animal agriculture are fighting to stop it. First of all, let's clear up what this is. It's, you say, and I think you refer that we've got to have a better name for this besides cell cultured meat. Yum, 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 right? Or simply cultured meat. Well, this is real meat that's produced without an animal. How?
Right. So, you know, it's of course complex, more complex than this, but on a simplest level, it is, it's pretty easy to explain. You basically need three things to make cell cultured meat. You need an animal cell, which can be taken, of course, from like a cow or a pig or a chicken. And these cells need food in order to replicate. And so that food is what's generally referred to as a liquid medium, which if you imagine inside your body or an animal's body, it's the blood that kind of delivers nutrients around the body to sort of supply cells with the power and energy that they need in order to replicate. It's no different in this case. The cells that you get from an animal feed on sort of this liquid medium that is filled with amino acids and proteins and all the things that you would find in a body. And they grow inside what looks like a beer vat. It's a bioreactor is what they call it. And it's basically just sort of a temperature-controlled, sterile environment that has all the right pH and oxygen levels that cells need to sort of happily grow into fat tissue or into muscle tissue. And put fat tissue and muscle tissue together when it's grown from animal cells, you get what is, on a molecular level and a nutritional level, real meat.
Mm. So in this, you're not making it any more appetizing, Chase. But a huge vat of of cell meat cell slurry. Does it turn solid? Is it liquidy?
Yeah. It's a solid mass, and you know it does sound strange, and I think that you know that's totally a normal response that some women have, including me. But if you think about what these sort of the earliest products that you're going to see are, they're chicken nuggets and chicken tenders and ground meat products. You know, ground beef in its raw form isn't exactly the most appealing looking thing either.
Right.
And what chicken nuggets are before they're breaded and fried doesn't look all that appetizing either. In mm-hmm. fact, it looks pretty much the same as what you're going to find when you open a bioreactor and it's time to harvest the cell cultured meat. The substances very much look the same. So not an appetizing thing to pull straight out of the system, but it looks and tastes and feels exactly like you would taste if it were made from like a conventional animal, at least the stuff that I've tried.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll get to that in a minute, but to the how to make thing, a question. So where do these cells come from? Do you take it from any part of, I mean, you describe it as a pinprick in this book. So you extract some cells from where in the cow or the pig or the chicken?
Right. Well, I mean, the science in this area is really, really impressive. And, you know, you can find cells that are good for harvesting off pretty much any part of the animal body. Some parts are better than others, but one company, the one that's at the center of this book, just has talked about how you can essentially take a cell off the tip of a chicken's feather, even a stem cell. And really what happens, the magic that happens inside like the lab or inside a food processing facility, is that you can basically take these cells that have lived their lives to produce feathers, and through, you know, a scientific process called dedifferentiation, you can send those cells back kind of into like a time warp to a state called a pluripotent state, where they can like choose a new life adventure. And you can direct these cells to grow into fat tissue or to muscle tissue. So the technology and sort of the science and innovation behind this is really incredible. But it can be, you can go through that process, or you can take a cell from like muscle tissue or fat tissue and grow it into such.
Mm-hmm. And so you could really dictate how much in your meat, how much is muscle tissue and how much fat, really down to just exact science, right?
You can. And in fact, like, that's really necessary because, you know, when you think about a cut of meat that you would eat, you know, a lot of that texture and stuff comes from the muscle tissue, but the flavor is really in the fat tissue. So it is sort of a game of proportions. But yeah, I mean, to answer your question, it's, you know, when you put those two together at the right proportions, it's exactly the same thing.
Okay. We're going to keep people waiting a little bit for how it tastes. I'll ask you that in a second. Let's talk about the let's talk about the economics here. I know, what did you've had some of this, and when you had it, I think this is years ago, there were fewer people who had eaten this sort of cultured meat than had gone to the moon. Was that right?
Yeah, no. It was a very wild experience, and that was the case. And still very few people have tried it.
I think
that'll probably be different within like a year or so.
Okay, that's primarily because of the economics. Where are the economics of this? How much does it take? How much money does it take to make a patty of beef, cultured beef meat?
I would say a patty of cultured beef right now costs in between, I mean, a patty, I don't know, a pound would probably cost in between $700 and $1,500, very loosely. And that sounds like a hell of a lot, and it is. However, I would just point out that back in 2013, when this product was introduced to the world on a stage in London by a Dutch scientist, it was $1.2 million per pound. So in 7 years, getting that down to $700 per pound was a lot. And the real catch is that all of that progress over 7 years was made without any of these startups having any sort of pilot production facility built, a sort of facility that's built to actually create meat at a reduced cost. And now you have about five companies in the world, including two in Silicon Valley, who either have built or are in the process of building pilot production facilities. So that cost will plummet pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And this works with any type of animal meat, with fish, shrimp, lobster as well?
Yeah, you have companies around the world who are working on shrimp. You have companies working on bluefin tuna, you know, duck, chicken. The two fun ones are there's one in Australia called Vow Food that's making kangaroo meat. And you even have a bespoke company making cell-cultured mouse meat for cat food.
Cell-cultured mouse meat for cat food.
That is true.
If you've just joined us, my guest is journalist Chase Purdy. In this first half hour, Billion Dollar Burger is his book, Inside Big Tech's Race for the Future of Food. Okay, let's get to the point. Set it up. Where did you try this cultured meat? This is meat where no animal is raised, no animal slaughtered, and you've tried it where and when?
So I've tried it several times, but the first time I tried it was in the headquarters at Just, which is at the center of the book. And what the very first thing they served me was sort of a cell cultured foie gras. Now, I didn't grow up eating foie gras. I still don't really eat foie gras, so that was kind of a foreign experience for me. But it tasted rich. It tasted like a meat product. So the next thing they brought out was duck chorizo tacos. That actually was the first thing I tasted where I was like, wow, this is this is really kind of hitting on something. Now, through the course of my reporting, I had more food, including an extremely impressive chicken tender made by a company called Memphis Meat in Silicon Valley. And not only did that taste like meat and have the feel of it, but when you ripped that chicken tender apart with your hands, it had all of sort of like the really complex, you know, when you cut into a chicken breast, you'll notice it's a little bit stringy.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out getting cells to grow linear fashion is a really complicated science, but they've nailed this. And so when I pulled it apart, it really was one of those wow moments. And then of course, at the very end of the book, and actually this is the last time I tried cell cultured meat, the end of my reporting, my mother and I sort of enlisted her to come with me to a cell-cultured meat company just in San Francisco, where we had chicken salad and fried chicken. And my mom, who is sort of this eternal skeptic of this whole project, she tried it, and to my surprise, she walked out, with her mind changed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you really thought about all the sensations you were feeling, the mouth feel, the taste. It's really quite complex, isn't it, to replicate? Well, this is meat. That's why it tastes and feels like meat. It is actually meat, unlike the high-tech plant-based burgers, Beyond Meat, and the Impossible Foods, right?
Right, yeah. And I mean, and you know, it is very different from the sort of the plant-based products. But the people who are making the plant-based products and the people who are making the cell culture meat products, I think their aim all the same. It's sort of that these products will be better for our climate than what traditional animal agriculture does. And they've kind of even, you know, both types, but I focus mostly on cultured meat, but both types of meat and the makers of it have sort of a new reason for making what they're making, which is, I mean, just think about how COVID-19, I mean, this is not just a climate fix tool. Now's an excellent time to be thoughtful about cultured meat, because we've watched as COVID-19 has exposed the weaknesses of the hyper-consolidated U.S. meat system and the havoc it's wreaking on workers and meatpacking plants, including, you know, a couple in Iowa, at least.
Let's go there.
Storm
because
Lake,
I
Tyson.
Iowa is the number one pork-producing state in the U.S. It's a top state for pork exports. Nearly a third of the nation's hogs are raised right here in Iowa. We have more than 6,000 pig farms. And I don't know, Chase, if you've been following the news here, that we had earlier this year, because of those major disruptions we referred to in pork production, we had pork production plants having to shut down because of sick workers. And this created these huge backlogs in hogs planned for processing. There were, and I've interviewed pig farmers, there were 4,000 hogs per day that weren't going to market. The farmers had no room for them eventually, and they had to be, hogs that were raised for meat had to be euthanized because there was such a bottleneck in the supply chain. So this would be avoided in cultured meat, a multicultured meat world of the future?
I mean, first off, I mean, I know, heartbreaking for any farmer that has to go through that process. And I know the stories out of Iowa and other places around this country have been very similar in that respect. And I mean, I ran the numbers back in, the last time I ran them was in late April. And if you look at the number of meatpacking plant sort of closures due to the virus, it showed nationally a decrease of about 36% for both beef and pork in terms of production. I mean, that is massive. And what cell cultured meat, you know, what the people who make it sort of can claim is that because all the meat that they're growing has to happen in sort of these very sterile environments where there are like fewer workers, and there's much more space between people, you know, can stand next to each other, that it's just a completely different, it's a reimagined sort of way to make meat. And so it wouldn't fall victim, they say, to something, you know, like COVID-19.
And these meat plants, it sounds like, unless they need some resource that is only, you know, particular to one part of the country, they could exist anywhere. Or do they consume a lot of water or other natural resources?
Yeah, much, you know, that's a conversation that's really bubbling inside this space right now as they've sort of watched as the virus has kind of spread across the country and hit our meat system is that, yeah, the question is, do you sort of have a centralized plant that supplies multi-states, or do you have them more regionalized and help sort of spur more local sort of agricultural economies? And one company that I talked to called Finless Foods in San Francisco, it's in Berkeley, actually, their CEO was telling me that when you grow fish, for instance, bluefin tuna is what his company is focusing on, is that it actually is kind of operates the exact same way that when you catch a fish, and that the sooner you eat it, the better it's going to taste. And so it actually makes sense to have like a facility or two in Chicago that would supply Chicago its bluefin tuna. And then you would do that for other sort of cities as well. It doesn't make as much sense to have like a centralized spot where if something bad happened and it had to shut down, it would have mammoth impact on the regional supply.
Maybe it'll be like we have microbreweries having popped up over the past 20 years.
That's how they describe you know what these facilities would look like is more like brewing facilities than, you know, sort of a laboratory. So yeah,
wow.
A lot of this meat is grown inside what they call bioreactors, but what bioreactors actually look like on the outside to a layperson is just sort of a big giant beer vat.
Right, a fermenter. We've got a few more minutes left. Journalist Chase Purdy is with me this half hour. $1 billion Burger, Inside Big Tech's Race for the Future of Food. He's a journalist working for Quartz. Let's really drive home a couple of points. I want to get in the final minutes here what this does, how this could help our environment, and then the resistance to it, and then maybe when this will actually be a reality. Let's go to the environment. What are the benefits, the chief benefits of cultured meat for the environment?
I mean, the chief benefit for this, of what people would say, is that 14% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions come from the animal agriculture system. And so in one sense, this is a really optimistic or promising tool to kind of tackle and get that number down as the world tries to address that issue. But it's also like a waste issue. I mean, you think about it, you know, when you think about a cow, it takes about 6 pounds of feed to cycle through a cow to get 1 pound of beef. And so, you know, and that's, this happens 65 billion land animals a year that we kill in order to make all the meat that we eat. You have more people are going to be consuming meat on this planet than, you know, more and more up until 2050, you know, the amount we're going to have to increase production of food is going to be about 70%. So we have a huge hurdle if we plan to like feed this growing world all the meat that it wants while also keeping this 14% greenhouse gas emissions number addressed. And the cultured meat companies think that they're the ones who can sort of step up and really offer a solution here.
Okay. So who are the people? What are the forces against the development of cultured meat?
A lot of cases like this is the same as many American food fights that's happened in the past, where you have like the already existing industry interests like the cattlemen who are not interested in this. You saw the same thing when, you know, margarine was brought over from France and the butter makers, you know, hated it. You see it today even when the milk industry is fighting against and the milk lobby is fighting against plant-based milks, the sort of almond milks and oat milks of the world. In the case of meat, the story is a little bit different. You do have ranching groups who are against the idea of cell-cultured meat, but this is a really nuanced story because big, massive companies like Tyson and Cargill are actually sprinkling investment into cell-cultured meat companies. And in fact, you know, former CEO of Tyson, Tom Hayes, appeared on Fox Business about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And in that interview, he didn't even describe Tyson as a meat company anymore. He described it as a protein company, basically saying that, you know, the consumers out there are interested in all kinds of protein and that there's a place for Tyson to be supplying those proteins to people, whether it's from plants, whether it's from conventional animal agriculture, or whether maybe even cell-cultured meat.
So this sounds like, by your description, by your book, in your view, this is not a question of if this happens, but when we transition to whatever degree to a cell cultured meat society, right? So when?
Right. So I think that even if the idea of cell cultured meat makes you raise your eyebrow or makes you feel kind of squeamish, I think it's still important that we be thoughtful about it, because there are enough forces at work here to make it a thing that it will be a thing. There's enough capital behind it. There are enough billionaire investors behind it. And there's enough science behind it that it's actually, in its basic form, it's ready for market now. Chicken nuggets, chicken tenders, burgers, meatballs, they're ready. The one thing that is stopping them or slowing them from getting to market is that they're all waiting for some government around the world, whether that's the U.S. or Singapore or the United Arab Emirates or Israel, they're waiting for the regulators to give the green light, to say, we have a system in place where we regulate these companies, we're ready for them to sort of go out into the market.
Chase, what is the biggest downside? You haven't talked about any downsides. What is the biggest downside for this cultured meat, lab-grown meat?
You know, that really depends on who you ask. When I write about it in the book, I am thinking a lot about, there are two things. One, the downside to me is that I would like to see cell cultured meat companies, basically kind of the cultural implications here. Will you be able to make all of the sort of the traditional recipes that you're used to? Will you be able to barbecue with cultured meat? Will a T-bone steak ever exist? Will that require growing bone as well? If these companies truly do want to replace conventional meat, I think that they have, thousands of years of human history to kind of consider as well. And so, that's a concern of mine. I think it's going to be easy to replicate the burgers. But what about, make Julia Child's beef bourguignon if you wanted? Could you open up a cookbook that your parent used to make whatever recipe you wanted with cell-cultured meat? I think all that's, to be determined.
Right. And so many fascinating questions as we approach this in the years to come. Well, thank you very much. Journalist Chase Purdy, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Fascinating work here. Chase's new book titled Billion Dollar Burger, Inside Big Tech's Race for the Future of Food. Check it out. It's very interesting. Coming up in just a moment, Iowa writer Chris Merrill. He witnessed and wrote about the civil war in former Yugoslavia. Now he's going to comment in this next half hour on the divisive forces at work in our country. That's coming up in just a moment after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.